I'm Algernon Cash, and you're locked in. This show is where we host thoughtful conversations about the issues shaping our communities, our economy, and our future. If you value these conversations, then I invite you to support this work. Your donations help us continue bringing together leaders and thinkers who are willing to have honest discussions about our state and country. Visit lockedin.cash to become a reoccurring supporter. Your contribution helps us continue producing independent conversations that elevate our region. Today, I'm joined by John Hood, president of the John William Pope Foundation and former president of the John Locke Foundation. President Trump recently traveled to China for high-level meetings with Xi Jinping. The visit generated enormous global attention because the stakes are incredibly high right now. And the broader question emerging is whether America's influence is strengthening or weakening in a rapidly changing world. But beyond the political theater, there are some serious economic and geopolitical questions that affect all of us, including right here in North Carolina. John, welcome back to the show, man. Thank you for locking in with me today.
Certainly. Thanks for having me.
So, yeah, I guess to sort of jump right into it, when you step back and look at Trump's visit to China as a whole, beyond the headlines and the photo opportunities, what do you believe was the real objective of the trip? And do you think the United States actually achieved meaningful leverage from it?
Well, the easy answer to the second question is no. I can't imagine that the president or the Trump administration or senior leaders in Congress really expected this summit to dramatically or even sort of noticeably change the relationship between China and the United States. To give the president a pass a bit on this, none of our recent presidents has been able to manage the relationship with China effectively. All new administrations come in and claim to start something new with China, but none of them seem to have a consistent and coherent strategy for what to do. If you're in America and you're worried about China, join the club. But if you also in America or the rest of the free world, and you think there was an alternative to China growing, developing economically, maturing, and having a greater sense of confidence in the world stage, then I think you're simply mistaken. There was no way that the United States, with our allies or without our allies, could have prevented any of that from actually happening. That was going to happen. And indeed, one of the greatest increases in living standards and well-being in the history of the world happened in China from the 1970s until recently. They went from an extremely poor country to a sort of moderately above average incomes. It's not a wealthy country, but it's way better off. Hundreds of millions of people no longer live in desperate, grinding poverty. And there's no reason for anybody in the rest of the world to be upset about that. We should be happy about that because we're all human beings. But as that happened, and China became first an exporter of what we might think of as lower value chain sort of goods and commodities, moving up towards being able to manufacture better products and better products and better products. Obviously, Chinese manufacturers and Chinese companies more broadly, even tech companies now, pose more of a competitive pressure on companies that might be based in the United States or Europe or Japan or something like that. So the trade relationship, the economic rise of China, I'm not sure I would describe it as a problem. It's a fact of life that is best handled in a serious and long-term way. Some of what China has done is actually move away from communism and towards freedom, economic freedom, not nearly far enough. And they have backtracked under Xi quite a bit. But the initial rise of China starting in the 1970s was the abandonment of central planning to some extent, and allowing more capitalism. That's what happened. So nothing we could do about that. That's actually arguably a good thing for the world. But there are still legitimate concerns. One of them is the cheating on intellectual property and other kinds of strong-arm tactics that are either fraudulent or violate international agreements. the extent to which China's growth and economic heft has corresponded with a greater confidence to assert territorial ambitions, not just the obvious one in Taiwan, but they have other territorial ambitions against in Southeast Asia. They insist that part of India is really Chinese. They have some pretty big ambitions, and we got to manage that. In addition to all of that, China is indeed part of an alliance structure that is explicitly anti-American, explicitly against the values of America and the West, believes that the principles that we hold dear, limited constitutional government, the rule of law, democracy, free enterprise, individual liberty, religious conscience, these are all things that the Chinese, to varying degrees, reject. Absolutely, not like pretend to be for, they simply reject them. And if that's all they do in China, we can be very upset about that, but it's not part of our purview to decide how the Chinese live. But the extent to which the Chinese attempt to obstruct our commerce, obstruct our trade, obstruct our relationships with our allies in the region, and attempt to subvert free economies, whether it be in South Korea or Japan or the Philippines, where it has also territorial ambitions against the Philippines, that becomes a real legitimate problem for us. So I set all that table, Algernon, because I don't think you can interpret Trump's meeting in Beijing or previous summits that he's had or all the stuff that he's done with Xi over the years without understanding that this is a geopolitical challenge that multiple administrations have tried to wrap their arms around. Now, I personally think that the Obama period, then the first Trump period, then the Biden period, then the second Trump period that we're in now has been especially ineffective in handling the Chinese challenge. In part, to give the Obama administration some credit, they were attempting to negotiate a free trade agreement, the Trans-Pacific Partnership. One of its purposes was to knit together all of these societies along the Pacific Rim from North and South America all the way over to Japan, Korea, the Philippines, Southeast Asia, et cetera, in a free trade agreement, and to say explicitly to the Chinese, you're not welcome unless you reform. So it was an attempt to box out the extent to which the Chinese are perfidious, cheaters and use pressure tactics and all that. This was an attempt to build an alliance structure to resist them. Unfortunately, Hillary Clinton in 2016 said, yeah, I'd get rid of it. Trump said, I'm against it. And it fell apart. Now, some of these other countries have persisted and they have put together an alliance structure to resist Chinese power. And America actually dropped the ball on that. So if I thought that Trump was going there to tell Xi, you know, I'm going to restart this process of really building strong political and economic and trade relationships with all these countries that you're spooked and all these countries that are scared of your invading them or messing with their islands or messing with their ship, you know, their shipping and their merchant fleet and their fishing boats, that would be great. That does not appear to be what President Trump is doing. And in fact, he disdains, unfortunately, many of the alliances that would be necessary to challenge China and its allies, which include Russia, Iran, Cuba, North Korea, and other bad actors around the world.
Yeah, you know, because when I stand back and I look at the coverage, I mean, with all the pomp and circumstance and all the optics that occurred in China, you know, President Trump came home with very little. I think he maybe came back with a pack of rose seeds is sort of what I heard in the news.
There were some promises to buy planes and stuff. I mean, these kinds of things are all meaningless, really. Some of these promises, not just with China, but with lots of countries, unless there's an actual treaty that has been ratified. And even then with China, I mean, that's not a country that follows treaties. It doesn't really mean anything. And a lot of times what these countries do, including China, is they say, yeah, we'll buy 200 planes. They're already going to buy the 200 planes.
It actually disappointed the market because the market expected they were going to buy 500 planes and they only bought 200. Mm-hmm. I know that NVIDIA has had a lot of questions around why China hasn't followed through on some of the chip purchases that they promised. So it does feel like to me that not a lot of tangible, things that you can really attach to came out of the conversation. But here's my next question, though. So when you look at Trump and going back to his first term and certainly even during his second administration, he built much of his political identity around confronting China economically and promising to sort of rebalance trade relationships. But as we just said, after the visit, it increasingly is more clear that fully decoupling from China may be far more difficult than political rhetoric even suggests. So where do you think our relationship with China is really heading?
Well, one tell of what is really happening is compare the rhetoric that President Trump uses about China with the rhetoric he has used about Canada or Mexico or Denmark, you know, with regard to Greenland. It's just more hostile to our friends. And yes, all of those countries are in fact our friends. They're our treaty partners in one form or the other. In the case of Canada and Denmark, they're our national security treaty partners. They're members of NATO. We are in a military alliance with them. And Trump sometimes jokingly, sometimes not jokingly, talks about invading them. And he's also talked about invading Mexico, which is not, as far as I know, a national security treaty ally, but it is a trading partner with which we have
and a neighbor.
Not just the renegotiated trading agreement, but lots of other agreements with Mexico. So when you have countries that we have deep and abiding relationships with and deeply connected, and no sane person would want to cut those connections, and you have this sort of bellicose rhetoric and even bad policy with regard to tariffs, and on the other hand, China, which I'm not in favor of levying stiff tariffs on, you know, baby strollers or things like that imported from China. But I am, as a free trade, free market guy, I certainly would worry about and do something about American dependence on critical national security materials from China, rare earths, other kinds of things that we actually need for our military defense from China. We shouldn't be doing that. We should be making those in the United States or in getting them from our allies, which is often a more cost-effective way to do it. And instead, what we have is a sort of a dance with Xi, which sometimes doesn't seem at all rivalrous, but more like he respects Xi a lot because she's powerful and, I don't know, has a really strong Musk or something. And then on the other side, our actual treaty allies in Europe and elsewhere and in the Far East that we seem to not treat with the same level of respect. I think if we were taking the Chinese challenge seriously, and we should, we would have a very different kind of relationship with South Korea, Philippines, Japan, Southeast Asia, India. We would have a much friendlier relationship with these countries. We would not be picking trade wars with them. We would be building stronger political and diplomatic and economic and cultural ties precisely to box China out and perhaps over time to force China to truly modernize, not just modernize its manufacturing base, but to like grow up and become a real power in the 21st century, which means ceding power to elected officials and having a real rule of law and having a real system and not being a sort of a communist dictatorship / kingdom that allows some free markets along the margins.
You know, one thing that really stood out to me was Xi Jinping's tone regarding Taiwan. You know, Taiwan is obviously central to global semiconductor manufacturing, while China controls, as you just shared, much of the critical mineral supply chain required to produce advanced technology. So these issues are deeply interconnected economically, technologically, and militarily. At the same time, Xi appeared to publicly pressure Trump to clarify where the United States stands regarding Taiwan and broader regional power dynamics. How should Americans start looking at the Taiwan relationship now?
Well, I would hope that they see Taiwan correctly as a longtime American ally. In fact, an American ally since the 1940s, this is nothing new, an ally that, while imperfect, as is the United States, more or less reflects our values, respects the individual rights and liberties of its citizens, has a democratic process, has a free enterprise system, is a friend to freedom domestically and internationally. And those are the kinds of friends I want. I don't know about you. Now, I think I understand the diplomatic need to not specifically push for Taiwanese independence. And I don't think you need to do that. All you need to say is it is the policy of the United States that we emphatically oppose any attempt to forcibly reunite Taiwan and China. Now, they might not even like the language of reunite because it suggests they're not the same country. But, you know, they're not. We don't have to go out of our way to antagonize the Chinese. But we should also make it very clear to them that there is no ambiguity. Like if the Chinese try to pressure Taiwan to surrender, we will come to Taiwan's defense. We don't need to say that explicitly. We can be very clear that we emphatically oppose in every way, shape, or form any attempt to conquer or coerce the Taiwanese. Period. That should be our policy. And it is, in fact, our policy right now. There is some creative ambiguity the diplomats have invented, but everybody can see through that. But the Chinese would probably respond really, really antagonistically towards is a U.S. declaration that we recognize that Taiwan is an independent country that deserves representation in the United Nations and so forth. They might very well see that as an act of war. And I don't think the Taiwanese actually want us to do that. But you can stop short of that and still make it very clear that not just an amphibious invasion or something, which I personally right now think the Chinese would be crazy to try, that the Chinese are making a tremendous number of mistakes, and their long-term future does not look rosy. Ours is better than theirs. They have a bigger demographic problem. They have wasted just billions and billions of dollars and all sorts of stupid investments that aren't going to pay off. So the Chinese have a lot of problems. But it is not really necessary for us to go out of our way to pick a fight. However, if they're not watching Ukraine, I'd be very surprised. They are watching Ukraine, and they recognize that the Russians thought they could just trounce the Ukrainians and do whatever they want, and the Russians did not understand how warfare has changed, and neither did the Ukrainians, but both sides have learned now. And the tide for now, the military tide has turned towards the defense. It is much easier now in a drone, AI-empowered military situation. It's much easier to defend than to attack and take territory. This should be freaking the Chinese out, and I bet it is. And we should be reinforcing to them, you should not attempt to invade China. You're going to fail. And I think they kind of know that, at least for right now. What a more likely scenario is they will attempt to embargo Taiwan. Like, for example, start stopping ships and saying Taiwan's part of China and you owe us, you know, some, you know, import duties or stuff. I mean, to do things that aren't a direct invasion, but are an attempt to create a crisis. And what we should make it very clear to the Chinese publicly and privately is those are attempts to forcibly coerce and conquer Taiwan. That is indistinguishable from invading Taiwan. And we will see both. We will respond the same way to both of those scenarios. That would be good for China in the long run. It's definitely good for Taiwan and the U.S.
What are your thoughts about the president's recent statement, like literally just within the last few days, saying that he's willing to talk to the president of Taiwan, which is something America has never stated before? And obviously, we've already seen a pretty swift reaction from the Chinese because of that. So what are your thoughts about it? And Donald Trump tends to be very unorthodox.
He does.
He approaches just about anything. So it doesn't shock me that he would openly and publicly. He seems to be willing to talk to anybody, quite frankly. I mean, he'll meet and talk with anybody. But does that start to change the dynamics of the relationship that we have with China?
I think that the president believes it might. I think you're absolutely right that he approaches diplomacy very differently because he doesn't have experience in this area. And one might argue good because a lot of diplomacy is a waste of time. I understand that argument. The problem here is that when time is on your side, you don't need to disrupt. Things are going in your direction. People seem to think that time is on China's side. In fact, perhaps the Chinese think that time is on their side, but it clearly is not. And the longer this goes on, and the more the U.S. and its allies rearm, which we are doing now, the more the Taiwanese rearm, which they are doing now, and the more that these technologies develop and Taiwan invests in drones and Taiwan has the information, it's just as important as drones and the successful defense of Ukraine has been the databases, the intelligence network, the satellite information, and AI, and how all of these things are integrated. Is to the extent Taiwan gets all of that in place in the next few years, Chinese ability to do anything is going to be dramatically lower than it is right now. So I'm not sure I think it's necessary to rock the boat in the way that the president is doing, to talk about for the first time having direct conversation president to president. I'm not necessarily against it. I'm just, it does have some risks associated with it. And I would think this is a sort of a, I'd rather be the tortoise than the hare plan. I would focus on build stronger relationships and build up the militaries of Korea, Japan, actually Vietnam is an ally in this case, or would be in theory, the Philippines, Australia, other Southeast Asian countries, and most importantly of all, in my opinion, India. I would want to see the president spend a lot more time talking to the head of India than talking to the head of Taiwan, because the extent to which we have a strong relationship with India, that is a serious deterrent to the Chinese becoming too adventuresome.
You know, only within a matter of days of Trump leaving or departing China, Russian President Vladimir Putin was meeting with Xi Jinping. Do you feel like that was coincidence? Was that actually staged? I mean, is it China trying to sort of reposition itself as a power broker on the world stage and maybe even send a message to their own domestic citizens, right? Like that, you know, we are a superpower. I mean, do you think that was the message that the Chinese?
I think you just answered your own question. That is exactly what they were doing. They have been trying to do that for years. Remember, China has this thousand, you know, multiple millennia year history. It considers itself to be literally the Middle Kingdom. You've got heaven, you've got, you know, below the earth, you have China. You know, everything else is really ultimately in the long run supplicants of China in their minds. Now, there was a moment and there were long moments in world history where you can make that argument. It isn't right now, but this is what she aspires to. He wants a sense of, well, all the world leaders have to come to me because I'm the arbiter of what happens increasingly in the world. That is not true yet. It is certainly his aspiration. But more importantly, Trump and Xi, however friendly they are publicly or privately, they're not allies. We're not allies of China. We're adversaries of China, not just rivals in economy. That's fine. Competition's good. No, we're actual rivals. Like, they want to conquer territory that belongs to our treaty allies. Okay. So they're rivals. Russia and China used to be rivals. They are not rivals. They are allies. Now, the senior partner in that alliance is China, and Russia is the supplicant. But it is that they absolutely staged that meeting to make it clear, you know, Donald Trump came begging, but I, Vladimir Putin, come to see my friend because we're allies. This is a contrast that they are absolutely intent on making clear. And you're right, in part for domestic audiences, both in Russia and in China, they want to reassure their often disappointed people that this alliance, this deal, this partnership is working. Even though Syria is no longer part of it, Venezuela is no longer part of it, Iran is teetering, Russia's been chased out of portions of Africa and Asia that it used to be in. The Armenians are about to declare greater independence from Moscow. The Azerbaijanis have already said, you know, we're not friends anymore, basically. So things haven't actually been going in the direction of the Moscow-Beijing axis. And they want to reassure their people at least. Oh, yes, it is. Oh, we've got a plan. Everything's fine. Trump is nervous. He's panicky. He's got to come to us to get help. And that's the message they're trying to deliver. I hope Americans don't believe it. I hope our treaty allies don't believe it. But, you know, they do have skilled propagandists.
Well, you talk about some of the weaknesses and the cracks that are emerging between Russia and China and that whole alliance. But talk a little bit about sort of what does the United States look like right now on the world stage when you look at our performance in Iran and the fact that the Strait of Hormuz is still closed. And we seem to be entering another quagmire with a Middle Eastern country. And despite the fact that, you know, the Secretary of Defense and the president continues to go around the country saying that we've already won the war and it's over, I think generally everybody feels like we haven't won the war and it's certainly not over and it's largely unpopular. But what message are we sending around the world right now?
Not a good one. On the one hand, we don't look like we can accomplish our articulated military objectives. And on the other hand, we look like troublemakers. I mean, people who don't like Iran, don't like China, don't like Russia, don't like autocrats in general, but also don't like to like be paid through the nose for gas or natural gas or whatever. They think that America was the trouble here, that America picked a fight that imposed lots of costs on everybody else in the world, that America was not prepared to win, or that didn't have enough justification to pick in the first place. Now, one could debate those propositions, but that is how much of the world sees it, including in Europe, including in parts of Asia. Now, the Middle East is more complicated. They're not all on the same page, but it is obvious that at least some of our allies on the Persian Gulf weren't quite sure we should have picked this fight, but now believe we better win the fight. And others believe they're not quite sure we should have picked the fight. And they sort of feel like in the short run, it would be better to make some sort of a deal with Iran and kind of weaken them over time rather than try to finish the fight. So part of what Trump is doing, again, to give him a little bit of grace here, not very much because I have some disagreements with him, but I think it's possible he may have resumed military action and particularly started escorting ships through the strait. But I think some of our treaty allies in the region have urged him to continue to negotiate. And he's trying not to be too cross purposes, particularly with the Saudis. And also the Saudis and the Emiratis, United Arab Emirates, they're now quite rivalrous themselves. The Saudis view themselves to be the natural leaders of the Middle East, the biggest country other than Iran and Egypt. And Egypt's no longer a leader of anything. So they think of themselves as the natural leader. And the Emiratis say, well, we don't need a leader. You know, we're all independent countries. So it's a complicated story. In my own personal view, if you were going to do this, you needed to be prepared to escort ships to the Strait. If you weren't as prepared to escort ships to the Strait, which we did back in the 80s during the Iran-Iraq War, if you weren't prepared to do that, you shouldn't have picked the fight in the first place. That's the way I see it.
Well, I think what's surprising, and as I'm listening to you, I'm trying to replay some of these press conferences back in my head that have been occurring the last 60 or 70 days since this conflict started. And it seemed to me that the administration have said repeatedly that they were surprised that Iran closed the Strait of Hormuz. So, I mean, it just sounds like the plan going into this was not well thought out. And then also here, just in the last few days, the New York Times reports that the original plan was allegedly to put Mahmoud Ahmadinejad back in control of Iran. Now, that was part of the regime change that Israel and America had discussed. So,
yeah,
have we just gotten ourselves into a mess here? Or,
well, you know, this question of Iran has not had an easy answer since the fall of the Shah, and in fact, even during the reign of the Shah, which was a problem in many ways, but better than what came next. Americans of both parties, during the Nixon and Ford administration, and during the Carter administration, didn't get it right, didn't know quite what to do about the Shah. So this is an old problem. The Ahmadinejad gambit, if that's true, that's just preposterous. I do not believe that, I know that the Department of Defense was prepared for safeguarding the Strait of Hormuz and escorting ships. They have been doing scenario planning on that for 50 years. I promise you that it is not true that people in the Pentagon were thinking, Hormuz, where's that? You know, that's they already had a plan. Now, what the president thought or what Heck Seth thought, I don't know. But I guarantee you the people who work for them had plans to guarantee the Strait of Hormuz. This is like a standard war fighting thing that people, we have all sorts of, we have plans to safeguard the Straits of Malacca. We have plans in case the Chinese try to blockade or attack Taiwan. We have plans that the Chinese try to take islands from Philippines or Japan. We already have various contingency plans. Maybe they're inadequate, but the notion that the administration as a whole had no idea this was a risk is not believable. But that doesn't mean the president or the Secretary of Defense, maybe they didn't know or didn't take seriously enough that scenario or had some sort of, this is going to be like Venezuela mirage in their minds. Now, I admit to being a little heterodox here, but I will point out that while it took too long and it too costly and they didn't plan for it, the United States obtained its objectives in Iraq. Now, maybe it was never worth doing, but yeah. Iraq is not a sponsor of terrorism. Iraq has a sort of, for the region, has a relatively representative government, also has decentralized power. The Kurds have a fair amount of autonomy. A lot of the villages have more autonomy than they had under Saddam Hussein. So Iraq is a case where the regime change, you could argue it wasn't worth the tremendous cost, but it in fact worked. There was a regime change. And the regime change was in a country that is much smaller and less populous than Iran. And if it took that many years and that much cost to obtain that, you know, moderately valuable objective, regime change in Iran should always have struck people as a good thing if it could happen, but extremely hard to accomplish and probably not worth the cost to attempt to engineer in the way that they're talking about. So if that was their actual plan, was, you know, the Iranians are going to rise up without arms, without guns, and overthrow this terror state that is ready for them. All that happened, of course, is tens of thousands of Iranians were again massacred. I'm in favor of regime change in Iran. Aren't you? But I mean, I'm not sure how you would do it or whether the United States has a role to play in it that's significant. It would be great if it happened. It would be very good if there was regime change in China. And I do not think it should be an explicit goal of the United States to try to engineer that outcome, because we're not going to be able to do it, and it's going to be extremely costly and dangerous. So that's where I am on this. Israel has its own national interests, which I totally understand, and I'm generally supportive of Israel. If Israel believes that the only way to safeguard their health and safety in the long run, the existence of the state, is to overthrow the government of Iran, maybe they're right. But they should have had a better argument to the United States, and the United States should have had a better plan than, we'll bomb a few things and blockade a few ports and put Mahmoud Ahmadinejad back on the throne, so to speak, of Iran. That was a rather silly plan.
Well, and we may never know if the New York Times article was totally factual or not.
They just published another article that we know is preposterous about the Israelis training dogs to rape Gazan prisoners is absurd.
Yeah. So again, we may never know, but it sort of a fascinating story. And I mean, I think what we do know is that the Israelis have been trying to sell America on the idea of attacking Iran for, you know, 30 or 40 years now. It just so happened that we had a president in office.
But now, attacking Iran is different from attempting to do regime change. I think the Israelis were correct. You simply cannot allow Iran, with its revolutionary ideology and its alliances with Russia and China, you cannot allow them to have nuclear weapons. The result would almost certainly be World War III. And I don't know what the outcome of that would be, but it would not be good for anybody. And so they're right about that, but that's not the same thing as like take Tehran and put your own satrap into the, you know, into the palace or something. You would blow up the missile facilities, the nuclear facilities, and then they rebuild them and then you blow them up again. That is actually a cheaper strategy and more likely to succeed than some elaborate regime change plan that reads like the plot of a bad novel, not a good strategic not a good strategy from the Pentagon.
Well, and I still think I think we all agree that Iran should not have a nuclear weapon. And to your point earlier, I think we all agree on what some of these outcomes are. We disagree on the method to bring about some of these outcomes. But, you know, our own intelligence reports from our own intelligence agencies said that Iran was not as close to getting a nuclear weapon as the American people have been sold. So I just hope that as we continue to get deeper into this, that we find some kind of exit strategy that makes sense, not only for our relationships in the Middle East, but also for our image and our identity on the world stage, because I think every country is watching what's going on right now.
Right now, I am strongly convinced that the only exit strategy that will somewhat offset the damage that you're talking about to American credibility, the only one is to reopen the Strait of Hormuz ourselves. I mean, to forcibly reopen the Strait. I know that's costly, but there no other outcome. If we accede to Iranian demands on this, they will have established that they control the Strait of Hormuz, which is not is simply not something we can live with and the rest of the world can live with. And it would be such a blow to American credibility. We can reopen and should do it. It will be costly. We might lose lives. We might lose ships. But we're here. We don't have time travel, and we can't go back and say, well, never mind. We're not going to do this thing, you know, 3 months, 4 or 5 months ago that we did. We did do it. And now we're here, and we simply cannot allow these pirates, these crazy, tyrannical terrorists to extort shippers or to assert they have some control of international commerce. They do not. They cannot be allowed to have it. That's not the same thing as regime change. It's just, we're not going to allow you to do this. We will escort these tankers. We will escort other ships. If you attack us, we will destroy you. If your little patrol boats come out, we'll sink them. You don't know what we're capable of. And that's what we should be doing right now, in my view.
Yeah, but I think, John, you know, for all Trump's tough talk, I just don't see a president that has he does
you
not
absolutely I agree with you about
the courage and the willingness to go that far with it. And I think that he is probably more thinking about his own self-identity and his own legacy and what people are going to say about him and all these things. And I think that's why we don't really have a clear sense of direction, is because we don't have clear leadership right now. And as you've taught me, even through our EA Morris program, it's, you know, to be a good leader, you got to have good followers. And, sure. And so I just don't trust this team and this administration that we have. But to your point, we are here now. We're in it. And as much as we would love to go back to the way things were maybe in January when gas was $70 a barrel, oil was $70 a barrel, that's just not viable right now. We don't even have a clear sense of how we're getting out of Iran. We clearly have some global economic challenges that we're going to have to manage and deal with this year as a result. But it feels like we're already shifting our sights to Cuba. What are your thoughts about the Department of Justice recently indicting Castro?
Well, I mean, he richly deserves it. But if
also
I was
96.
Making, I mean, if I was making a list of foreign policy priorities, this would not be on it.
Yeah,
it just wouldn't. Okay, we've got set aside the issues we've already talked about. China's the big one. Russia and its invasion of Ukraine and threatening the rest of Europe is the second biggest one, or maybe right now the more proximate one even than China. But certainly those two are bigger actually than the crisis in Iran. Crisis in Iran maybe number three. And then you keep going down the list, you know, rebuilding our relationships with our allies that have been disrupted because of rhetoric and tariffs and all that sort of thing. All those things are more important than Cuba, in my view. I feel sorry for the Cubans.
Yeah.
And I wish they would, again, I wish there would be regime change in Cuba, but I'm not convinced that American troops or American might being used in some direct way would be worth the cost at the moment. And so I'm not shocked that there will be an attempt to change the subject, but it's a good example of, you know, keep your eye on the ball. Cuba is not the ball. That is not. In fact, if you resolve some of these other things, the Latin American relationship with the Axis would kind of resolve itself. I mean, if Russia was really distracted by existential concern, and China was back on its heels because it has come to their it's become very obvious to them that they cannot push India, Japan, Vietnam, Philippines, Korea, the U.S., and Australia around anymore. If they ever thought they could, they can't now because our alliances are stronger, our militaries are stronger. We got all these new, we've imported all these drones from Ukraine, which is now the arsenal of freedom. if we did all of that, the Venezuela-Cuba problem would get a lot better for us without doing anything to Cuba and Venezuela.
Yeah. Well, I've got a couple more questions for you before I let you go. Right. We've talked a lot about world politics and everything going on around the world, but to bring it back home here, feels like at least recently Trump has been at war with his own party, certainly going after a number of incumbents, not only at the congressional level, people like Representative Massey and Senator Cassidy, but he's also been going against, coming after incumbents in state legislatures around the country. I asked you this question actually some time ago, maybe a year, year and a half ago. I want to bring this question back up. Are we seeing a severe fracturing within the Republican Party? It feels like to me, and I've said this since Trump 1.0, it feels like Trump is slowly destroying the Republican Party from within. And when I look at how all of a sudden through his endorsement power, he's now going after incumbents, it's turning these primaries into situations where primaries used to be a process where we would vet candidates and we would look at, debate policy ideas and those kind of things. Now the Republican primary is just a test of who's loyal to Donald Trump.
Well, yes, and it's been that way now for many cycles since 2018. The results are not pretty. They don't always work out badly. I mean, there have been candidates endorsed by Trump. They defeat the other candidates in the primary. They win the general election and they turn out to be okay. I mean, there are some examples of that. But there are more examples of candidates who Trump endorses in the primary and they lose in the primary, a few. More of those are, more than that would be examples of Trump has endorsed people in the primary. They were not the best candidates and they lost in November. We've seen that happen many places over the years, right? Think about Senate races in Arizona.
Georgia.
Georgia. We look at House races where the same thing has happened. Look at governor's races, including, I might point out, to North Carolina. I mean, Trump wasn't entirely responsible for the 2024 disaster, but he certainly was part of it. And that candidate turned out to be a complete and utter disaster. We don't have to think, well, in the future, Trump putting personal loyalty and vengeance above electoral prowess is bad for the GOP like years from now. No, it's already been bad for the GOP. It cost them the Senate majority in 2022.
Totally agree.
It might very well cost them both the House and the Senate in 2026. And the Paxton endorsement in Texas, in my view, is actually, other than maybe Carrie Lake or Mark Robinson, the most outrageous, because Paxton is a he is such a thoroughly disgusting, despicable human being. The notion that you would endorse him for coroner in some rural county, I mean, he's not qualified to be coroner, but frankly, not qualified to be anything. The fact that you would choose him at all for anything at this point is indefensible. But worse than that, Texas is it's a more Republican state, of course, than North Carolina. Generally speaking, the Senate candidates are going to win. They're not always overwhelmingly. Ted Cruz didn't win overwhelmingly in his last election. But it is certainly, if you went with John Cornyn, the incumbent, he would almost certainly win. What you've now done with Paxton, if he gets the primary win next week, is that you're going to put him up against a not terrible Democratic candidate in a good Democratic year. Paxton could still win because it's not North Carolina, it's Texas. It's not Georgia, it's Texas. But all the money and the energy is going to be sucked to Texas to defend that seat. This was one of the worst news cycles for Michael Whatley, because Whatley's already well behind a candidate who's been elected so many times statewide and has a positive name recognition in Roy Cooper. So not impossible for Whatley to come back, but it's hard. It would require significant amounts of investment. A lot of that money's not going to go to North Carolina now. It's going to go to Texas try to defend a seat that the Republicans shouldn't have to spend a lot of money to defend. And by the way, Texas is a very expensive state to run in. It has something like, I don't know, four of the top five or six, or maybe five, maybe four of the top seven media markets in the country in terms of cost. It's very much more expensive to run than North Carolina per voter. And so it was horrible news for Michael Whatley. Just horrible news.
But what is the strategy behind this? Or is there any strategy? Is it just that no advisor or no strategist can get to the president? It's just his decision?
He's heard it all. No. They all get to him. You know, he did delay this endorsement for a long time. In fact, there was a moment when people thought he was going to endorse Cornyn because he was listening to the advisors at the moment. The thing about Trump is, it's not as if you can't talk to him. Lots of different people talk to him and talk him this way and talk him that way and talk him this way and talk him that way. But usually he ends up doing what is instinctual. And what is instinctual is who's my better friend? If I endorse Paxton, he will literally do whatever I tell him to do.
Yeah.
If I endorse Cornyn, he will usually do what I want him to do. For Trump, ultimately, that is an easy decision. I want the guy who will always bow to my whim. And it's not as if we're not all subject to that kind of temptation, you know, right? But you're supposed to use some judgment here. And in risking the Senate seat by refusing to endorse John Cornyn, who has voted for almost everything Trump would have wanted, because you want someone who's more, even more full-throatedly a supplicant, I just think it's political malpractice. But again, this is not new. This happened in the 2020 Sioux cycle in many places. Seats that the Republicans should have won, they lost because they got bad candidates. Pennsylvania, bad candidates because Trump endorsed them. I mean, that's just as simple as it can be.
Yeah, I mean, even Representative Massey voted with Trump 90% of the time, but mm-hmm. but still, obviously, you know, came into his sights there. And I just don't, it doesn't feel like Trump thinks long term. I mean, obviously, I don't think a lot of these candidates that he's endorsing will fare that well in the general election anyway. So to your point, he's put both chambers of Congress into play where originally Democrats only had a shot at winning the House. And now they actually see a pathway to also take the.
It's not necessarily the most likely outcome, but it is. It would not be surprising at all if they lose the Senate too.
It's probable. And then, you know, even here locally, like local races, local city council races here in the Triad of North Carolina, we've seen outcomes affected by what's happening nationally over in Greensboro and Kernersville. So you just see this all cascading down. I also think the president has created some enemies. These people have 6 or 7 months left in Congress. And I think you're gonna see Senator
we're
Cassidy.
We're already seeing that.
They're already right moving to the side of the aisle.
Yeah, we're going to see more of that. He's going to be frustrated for the next several months on some issues that he wants things from the Senate. He's not going to get it.
Because Tillis has definitely been a thorn in the side of the president since he announced his retirement. And he continues to be on his tour of just being very open and honest about how he feels about these issues. Here's my last question before you go. Here in North Carolina, lawmakers in Raleigh are proposing a constitutional amendment to cap the income tax at personal income tax at 3.5%. They've also proposed a constitutional amendment to cap property tax revaluations. I know because you and I've been friends for so long, so I already know that you're in favor of lower taxes. So I don't want to go there. I'm more wanting to play devil's advocate with you. I mean, if Raleigh is starting to insert itself on what local communities can do with property taxes, is that overreach? And then also with the personal income tax, if they're going to cap the personal income tax at 3.5%, shouldn't we also be having a pretty substantive conversation right now about what we're going to do to cap services?
Well, yes, I think your concerns about these amendments are valid. On the property tax one, what you're basically doing with this amendment is allowing the legislature to set a sort of a taxpayer bill of rights cap on annual property tax revenue. It's not a cap on all local government revenue. And similarly, you're going to be capping the personal income tax rate at 3.5%, but not the sales tax rate or other levies that the state may come up with. So I am concerned that at least for some lawmakers, what this really is an attempt to set the stage for a bigger sales tax. This is really because neither of these touch the sales tax. And there are members who do believe that it would be better for North Carolina to pay for state and local services to a greater extent with sales taxes. I'll tell you, Algernon, I don't necessarily disagree with that if the sales taxes are properly structured. But they're not going to be because they're not going to be applied to hospital bills. They're not going to be applied to bank fees. They're not going to be applied to hiring a lawyer, you know, an individual hiring a lawyer. And they will often be applied to business-to-business transactions, which are not retail and therefore shouldn't be subjected to the retail sales tax. So I don't think the sales tax will ever be structured properly. If it were, I might like this idea, but I don't think that's going to happen. So I'm concerned about that. I will tell you, both of the amendments have passed, both chambers. They will be on the ballot this fall. And unless I'm absolutely, you know, wildly mistaken, they will both pass. And so these are going to be policies after November, I think. So I think the best thing, now here's my, you're right, I do want to lower taxes and I'm fine with the general direction here. But one dream I have in the future is actually reducing the federal government, reducing the size and scope of the federal budget, because otherwise we're in big trouble. And one of the things that will do is states will have to pick up some of the things that the federal government used to fund. It might be at some point in the future we'll have to amend the Constitution to allow a higher income tax rate, not because we want overall higher taxes, but because we have to pay for things at the state level that used to be paid for in Washington. So that's one thing I'm concerned about. But anyway, these amendments are going to be law. And so my view now is let's make sure they don't become backdoor ways for the government to invent new and less efficient ways to tax us.
This has been another episode of Locked In with Algernon Cash. John, I appreciate your time and your perspective. These are complicated issues. And one of the reasons I value conversations like this is because they help people move beyond surface level politics and better understand the deeper economic and geopolitical shifts taking place around us. If you value these conversations, then I invite you to support this work. Your donations help us continue bringing together leaders and thinkers who are willing to have honest discussions about politics, business, money, and the community issues most important to our state and country. Visit lockedin.cash to become a reoccurring supporter. Your contribution helps us continue producing independent conversations that elevate our region. You can also subscribe to my podcast on YouTube, Apple, and Spotify. Share this episode and send it to a friend. I'm Algernon Cash. Y'all stay locked in.
The executive producer of the Locked In podcast is Algernon Cash for WGC. The associate producer is Tim Beeman for Such and Such Media. This podcast is copyrighted and cannot be reproduced without express written consent of WGC.